Good morning.
Good morning.
It's very good. It's so good to see you all today. I'm excited to be able to share this last week of Facing the Giants as we close out this series. And just as we get started, I want to show you a video by a guy named J.D. Sears, and he, or maybe it's even J.P., sorry, I called him the wrong name, J.P. Sears. He's a life coach, and he's a comedian, and he's got a little bit of something to say about how to win the approval of people. So let's go ahead and hit those lights and go ahead and cue the video and take a look at this.
After many years of searching, I've discovered that the purpose of my life is to get other people's approval. I don't like myself at all, so I try to get others to like me. And when they do, I like that they like me, which makes me feel like I like myself, even though I don't. Two questions you need to ask yourself: who do I need to become, and how do I need to act in order to get this person to like me? When you get approval, it gives you a deep, permanent satisfaction of feeling happy for about 5 minutes. And if you don't get people's approval, it means you're unlovable, flawed, and you make people's lives worse just for existing. If people saw the real me, they could never love me. But when I'm being who I think I should be, then people can definitely love the person who I'm pretending to be. I recommend hiding your authentic personality traits because they might make people not like you. And if you hide them, then people cannot not like you because you're not exposing any of you to them for them to not like. You're protected. If someone doesn't like you, then you have no business liking yourself. You don't want to express your natural gifts and brilliance because most people don't express theirs. You actually hurt people when you shine because it reminds them that they don't allow themselves to shine. And they'd certainly disapprove of you for that. Let me break it down for you. If this jar is you and these rocks represent your innate gifts, then you want to put your gifts inside of you where they belong. And then you want to put the lid on the jar. And then you want to never take the lid off the jar. You'll definitely want to carry the burden of living out your parents' failed hopes and dreams. Whatever they didn't have the courage to try should be on your shoulders now. 5 years ago, I sat down with my parents to have them coach me on how I can be less of a severe disappointment to them. It turns out to get my father's approval, all I have to do is make millions and never show any emotion. And all my mother wants from me is to give her grandchildren, never let another woman be more important to me than she is, and for me to be completely responsible for making her happy. No problem. It absolutely eats away at me when I don't get enough approval. I've actually never quite gotten enough. But because it's really hard for me to breathe right now, I can only assume that after 36 years of trying the same thing over and over again, that I'm now on the verge of finally getting enough approval to make me truly happy. And that's how you win people's approval.
Obviously, that's a parody, right? There's a lot of sarcasm there. There was another service where they were like, all stone silent. You know, just like, it's like, that was kind of a joke. Okay, but anyway. But there's one YouTube commenter on this video. It's interesting, and I think it's insightful, and it's kind of tough, you know. I just realized, this is what this person wrote, I just realized this is my entire life philosophy, but it's not a parody. That was funny. It's not when it's your life. So I'm going to ask you some questions, and I just want you to think about these questions. Don't answer them out loud. These are rhetorical questions. All right, if you answer them out loud, it'll get uncomfortable real quick, okay? Where do you look for approval? What causes insecurity in your life? And where do you feel the most need to impress? See what I'm saying about uncomfortableness? Think about it. You don't have to answer out loud. Where do you feel the most need to impress? For me, and I want to talk to you about my most insecure environment, the most insecure place. It is the gym. It's going to the gym. And it's been that way for a long time. I don't feel like I'm the most athletic person or the best in shape person or I can lift the most weights. So the gym is a very uncomfortable environment. I just started a membership at Summit Fitness, which is great and also awful all at the same time. And it goes back to eighth grade. When I was in eighth grade, I got trapped under a bench press. This is not me in eighth grade. That guy is so ripped. So But I remember being in eighth grade and being at the high school. And the high school, I was in eighth grade, and so I was going to this high school, and they had this open gym, and everybody was there, right? Because that's just, I guess, what you did. And then I got to high school and promptly never went to the gym again. Okay, so I got trapped under a bench press, and this dude had to come lift it off my body. And it was in this gym full of people, and it was, yeah, it's about as mortifying as you guys are all looking at me right now. It is pretty terrible. And I would attend that high school for the next 4 years, and it was just a source of insecurity. Even in sports, I ended up getting cut from the teams in high school. Fast forward nearly 2 decades, that baggage still haunts me, and so I go to the gym, and I hate it. And I'm so insecure. And I look at myself in the mirror every single day, and I know I could be in better shape. I look at myself, I can see myself being in better shape. Then, and this is, the people at Summit Fitness are so great. Your first, or I mean that sincerely, that's not sarcasm. They're really great, they're great people. One of the things they do when you first get there is they give you a fitness assessment. Some of you guys are laughing. They give you a fitness assessment. It's really insightful, and for me, it's scientifically confirmed that I could lose weight. So, and they do a flexibility thing, which I hadn't stretched since middle school. So I was like, dude, this is going to be really bad. He's like, it usually is, you know? And so I stretched, and he made me do it again. Like, he didn't believe me. Like, I was understretching, you know? And he's like, okay. I was like, yeah, man, my legs are made of wood. I'm sorry, you know? But I go into the gym, and it's just not a secure environment. I mean, the people are great, but it's just my perceptions of how their people are viewing me, which they're not really thinking. It's all in my head. I know. And I don't really know what I'm doing. That's the other thing that makes it tough. I don't know about you, but I'm insecure when I have to do something new I've never done before that I'm not good at. It's a humbling experience. And when you go to the gym, Good. Thanks for throwing this up, Julie. This is me. I try to go to the gym where no one will be there. And there's always people there. I don't get it, you know? It's like, where is that perfect time? But I love it when there's no one in the gym because I can just work out and feel unjudged. But the thing is, no one is judging me. It's all in my head. And when it comes to the instructions on the gym equipment, I don't want to go into the gym and read the instructions because people will see me read the instructions, right? And they'll be like, this guy doesn't belong here. You know what I mean? Nobody's thinking that. Where is the guy in the gym that's just pointing at people with his thumb? You know, he doesn't exist. She doesn't exist. They're not there. It's all in my head. But you have to know how to use the equipment, or else you end up like you end up as a meme. People meme you, right? You know what I mean? Like this guy, like, good for him. Bro, that's not how it goes. That's not how it works. I always go to the gym. I don't always go to the gym, but when I do, I have no idea what I'm doing. And this last guy, I just love it. I love it for all of his effort and zeal. When I grow up, I want to be like him, you know? Have the courage to try and not worry about it. So you have to read the instructions, but it's uncomfortable for me, and it's just an uncomfortable environment. And I say good for every single one of those people that got in there and tried it, even though some of them had no idea what they're doing. The problem isn't with the gym. The problem isn't with the people in the gym. It's not with the idea of the gym. It's me. It's a me problem. It's always been a me problem. And it comes out here, but it comes out in other ways too. It's letting the way others see me impact the way I see me. And this leads me towards trying to win people's approval. Approval addiction. People pleasing. Call it what you will. Call it what you want. But it looks like this. This is a working definition. It's allowing the opinions of others to shape, influence, or determine my self-value, my self-worth, and my identity. I've struggled with it for years. It's not a ministry thing. It's a Justin thing. I've struggled with it for a long time in multiple careers. Even when I was a teacher, I had to have that moment where I realized I wasn't there to impress people. I was there to teach kids. But it's tough, and for me, this creeps in all the time. Maybe it's you. And the self-talk, right? I talked a little bit about how you talk to yourself or the thoughts going on in your head. That self-talk is so ridiculous. It's always far more destructive, more comparative, more unfair, more unreasonable than what anyone else is ever thinking about me. And then here's the reality. Honestly, probably nobody's thinking about me that much. But seriously, that's something about this approval addiction, that when you're in it, it makes you so self-focused, doesn't it? You can't think about anyone else. So let's not kid ourselves that the more insecure you are, the more humble you are. Insecure people aren't humble people. I know, sometimes I am, and I'm not humble, okay? Because we're thinking about ourselves all the time. It has a big price tag. Maybe you've spent a little bit, right? Maybe you've seen this price tag in action. It's exhausting, right? To try and be everything to all people never works out very well. You're always really tired. It really damages relationships. Openness is kind of reciprocal. When you put the mask on and keep people at an arm's length, they do the same to you. We match a lot. It's just what happens. It ruins rejoicing, right? Comparison ruins rejoicing. Because if I'm trying to be impressive to other people and they do something impressive, I don't have the humility to agree that that was impressive. They're great. Instead, I'm thinking about my achievements in comparison to theirs. And that just makes it, right? The word of God says, rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn, and you can't rejoice with people. You just can't. Because it's all about you. I'd say it's all about me. It impairs good decision-making. We make sacrifices that we know we shouldn't, of family, of friends, of time, of rest, of money, of physical, emotional, and spiritual health, all on the altar of making people happy that we don't really care about. Honestly, we don't really care about, but we do. And honestly, I'm gonna be really honest with you. Nobody sees the disappointment on my daughter's face when I come home late from trying to impress somebody else. No one sees it but me. That's not a weight anybody else has to carry but me. And it sucks. And I'm tired, and maybe you are too. And what is there to do about it? Because I don't want to live like this anymore. And there's the person, right? There's people who remind you all the time, hey, I don't care what other people think about me. And yet, they always tell other people how much they don't care about what other people think of them. For me, I know when I've said that, sometimes it's been more of this smokescreen to be seen as someone who's strong, independent, has it all put together. And I don't. But I want to be seen that way. And if you're the person that's really comfortable in your own skin, good for you. I'm just not there. Always. And I'm not there in certain areas of life either, for sure. So this whole series, we've been talking about facing the giants, right? These different giants that eat our lunch from the fridge, that make our lives tough. Some of them are observable, some of them are hard to see. Thus far in the series, we've talked about anxiety. That was the first week. We talked about consumerism. These things rob us of joy, and they rob us of contentment. But approval addiction, this people-pleasing component, it really steals our freedom, and it really enslaves us to the opinions of other people. It's a freedom issue here. And that freedom brings joy. But the thing is, I started looking at it. I was thinking, okay, so this is what my message is about. Is it going to be about people-pleasing and approval addiction? And then I started kind of peeling back the layers, and it's really not about that. Because the reality is, approval addiction isn't the root cause. It's a symptom of the bigger problem. I'm pushed towards this because of something bigger, not because of that thing. And so all the times I've tried to treat that thing, I haven't gone to the root. And it turns out that the symptom, the root of it all, is really insecurity. It's the giant of insecurity that moves us towards approval addiction. It's nothing new under the sun, right? This isn't something that's like insecurity, never heard of that before, you know? Or like, is this something new people are dealing with? No! Insecurity has been there for thousands of years, and it's a giant, and it rears its ugly head, and it doesn't operate under the principles of faith. And Paul addressed this. There's a church planner a couple thousand years ago named Paul. And as he was starting the churches, he wrote these different letters to them. It's kind of how he kept in contact. And he writes this really profound insight when it comes to this idea of insecurity, when it comes to this idea of approval addiction, of people-pleasing, call it what you will. And he wrote this letter, and so I want to share, I want to talk about it together, and I really want to give you three responses to execute that giant of insecurity. Whatever it may be, I've shared a little bit of my story, yours is different, but there's still something that's there. And I think what Paul has to say in this letter to this church will help us. So let me talk about the church really quick. All right, you ready? The church is not a healthy church at all. It's not a healthy church. Lots of issues in this church. This church is in the ancient city of Corinth. They called those people there Corinthians. Okay, it's not a healthy church. It wasn't really healthy. Lots of division, lots of quarreling. People are sleeping around and bragging about it, right? Just the idea of they're just doing things they know are totally incongruent with the way Jesus would say to do things. And it's not like they're bent out of shape about it. They're like all on board with it. Okay? People are suing each other in the church. All this stuff is going down that you even look at like that's a really unhealthy. I wouldn't want to go to that church. I know, you know? And there's another source of huge conflict in the church, and it has to do with kind of the way people are puffing themselves up, right? So basically what had happened is you had Paul come in here. He was the church planner. He started the church, and so a lot of people had a relationship with him. And then over time, he went to the next place, and there's a guy, Apollos, came in, and he started teaching and leading. Other people developed a relationship with him. And then there's, at some point, it seems like the Apostle Peter came in there to visit, to connect, and he connected with a lot of people. So you've got three different leaders, and now what people are doing is their name dropping, right? You've heard in our culture, it's all about who you know and are known by. And that's what's going on. People are finding their value, their worth, their boasting, their bragging privileges, and who they know and are known by. And it's causing a lot of conflict. It's not different than today. High school is dominated by roughly the same principle, okay? Who you know and are known by. And so Paul writes this. He says this in 1 Corinthians 3. So then, no more boasting about human leaders. Great, end of the sermon, just kidding. No more boasting about human leaders. Then he keeps going on. He says, this then is how you ought to regard us, as servants of Christ and as those entrusted with the mysteries God has revealed. And then he goes on. Now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. In essence, he's saying, no more boasting about people. We are ministers. We got a job to do. Let us do our jobs. And then he says something that's really, I think, kind of funny, because it's so bold. And honestly, when you see it, who talks like this? He says this, I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. And the word judge there is the same word as rendering a verdict. So he says, I basically don't care what your verdict on me is. He's in essence saying, I have a very low opinion of your opinion of me. You're great. But he's writing this in a letter. Who starts off a letter like that? Like, dear grandma, I'm a very low, you know what I mean? Like, who fires off an email like that in the office? Nobody. I just love Paul's boldness. I want more of it. But in there you see the first response to executing this giant of insecurity. It's this. Reject the trap to seek the approval of people. Reject the trap to seek the approval of people. Which is kind of funny and kind of really on the baseline, okay? And if you're like, great, thanks, Justin. How do I stop trying to impress people? Stop impressing people. Like, okay, I hope there's more. It's not exactly rocket science, but it's the baseline. It's the first point. It's the starting point. And most of us, we hear that and we're like on board. We're on board with that. It's logical. But the other challenge is this. If I kind of reject other people's opinions of me in order to give value to myself and have identity, where do I get it? Where does my validation, my self-regard, my security, where does that come from? It's like a gap, an ever-present gap that just is longing to be filled, right? And the easiest place to go at that point is in ourselves. And this is exactly right. We define ourselves. We choose our identities. We determine what we're worth. And this is what our culture says, doesn't it? Most counselors, psychologists, therapists, psychiatrists, they'd all be on board with Paul's advice to worry less about what people think of you. Right? Makes sense? You'd step into their office, and they'd have that conversation at some point. But then they would, most of them, because apart from Jesus, this is the standard. And then they would say, choose your own standards. Decide who you want to be, and then be that and be comfortable. It only matters what you think about yourself. As parents, right, aren't we coached? Gotta help your kids have high self-esteem. High self-esteem just means you think about yourself very highly, right? Isn't it? We're coached, we gotta help our kids have good self-esteem, which means high self-esteem, higher self-esteem. We're told that the problems in our culture and world are because people have such low self-esteem, which is so interesting because up until like 120 years ago, the problem for all, what they thought the problem for all the world's issues were, was too high a view of yourself. It's just changed. What will it be another 120 years? I rightly don't know. But Paul says something, right? Because our tendency is when we reject the trap to seek the approval of people, there's a vacuum, and that vacuum wants to fill it with us, giving ourselves our own identities. And so Paul's next piece of coaching is really weird in light of that, but he tells us where to go next. He says, I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. He follows it up with this, indeed, I do not even judge myself. I don't even have a verdict on myself. He's basically saying, I have a very low opinion of your opinion of me, but I also have a very low opinion of my opinion of me. And at this point, the dude's just weird. You know what I mean? It's just interesting advice. It's weird advice. What does that mean? Good for you, Paul. So you just feel bad about yourself all the time, and no one can fix it. You know what? What? I don't get it. What's going on? But yet you seem so confident. You seem so cool and calm and collected. This just takes a confidence that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to any of us, or doesn't always make sense to me. But in that, you see the second trap. We see the second trap. We see the second response to execute that giant. It's this: resist the trap to create your own value. Resist the trap to create your own value. It doesn't work to build out your own value, your own security, your own identity. It just doesn't work. It is a trap. It fails every time. It just does. If you've tried it and been unsuccessful with it, then you know what I'm talking about. Tim Keller says something really interesting, and I want to read it to you. There's this little book called The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness, and that's really what he talks about. A truly humble person is the person that doesn't think highly of themselves but thinks about themselves less. And he talks about how to do that. So it's a really interesting book, but he says something about this trap to create your own value. And he says it better than me. I'm going to read it to you, okay? What would Paul say to those who tell him to set his own standards? He would say it is a trap he will not fall into. You see, it is a trap to say that we should not worry about everyone else's standards, just set our own. That's not an answer. Boosting our self-esteem by living up to our own standards or someone else's sounds like a great solution, but it does not deliver. It cannot deliver. I cannot live up to my parents' standards, and that makes me feel terrible. I cannot live up to your standards, and that makes me feel terrible. I cannot live up to society's standards, and that makes me feel terrible. I cannot live up to other society's standards, and that makes me feel terrible. Perhaps the solution is to set my own standards. But I cannot keep those either, and that makes me feel terrible, unless I set incredibly low standards. Are low standards a solution? Not at all. That makes me feel terrible because I realize I'm the person that would set low standards to begin with. Right? It's just a trap. It just doesn't work. Paul echoes this. In verse 6, he says this. Now, brothers and sisters, I have applied these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit. The other things we've talked about. Then, and he uses this phrase, then you will not be puffed up and being a follower of one of us over against the other. He's talking about you won't be puffed up and name dropping. You won't be puffed up in something else. And really, that word is a super interesting word. It's a different kind of word. Most of the times when the Bible talks about boasting or it talks about pride, it uses the word hubris. This is a word that doesn't mean that. It's a totally different one. It means overinflated, swollen, distended beyond proper size. That's why they call it being puffed up. He says, you're puffed up. And really what he's doing is he's giving us insight on what, another image, and this is a tough one, I'll show you. Think about this poor little baby, right? You know, sometimes when they're little, this child had some kind of allergy they didn't know about. It's causing a lot of stomach bloating and eventually fixed it. But you know what I mean? But Paul's giving a very vivid image and very vivid word picture, saying when we build our identities on anything different than Jesus, they're ultimately going to be inflated, swollen, distended beyond proper size. And then that word picture creates a few characteristics. And Tim Keller kind of lays these out also in that book. Let me just give them to you really quick. First of all, empty. When our identity is built on anything, right, that overextended, bloated, it's empty. Anything that's overinflated with nothing at the center is empty. When our identities are built around something that's originally designed for God to fill, nothing's as big as him, so things are going to rattle around a little bit, aren't they? And that's why status, careers, money, satisfaction, it lasts for all of 5 minutes. Outer applause never translates into lasting inner applause. It just doesn't. It just doesn't. The other characteristic is painful, right? Anything that's swollen like that poor baby, right? I mean, it just hurts to look at it. When something's swollen like that, it's going to hurt. And the reality is, I just want to share this, you don't think about parts of your body unless they hurt, right? For example, I don't think about my nose till it's clogged with snot. I don't shoot myself a look and be like, you got a good-looking schnoz, Justin. You know what I mean? I don't do that. The only time I think about my nose and how I wish I could take it off my face is when I'm sick. So usually we don't think about parts of our body unless they hurt. So when we say our feelings hurt, that's weird, because being hurt is a feeling. How do feelings have feelings? I don't think so. It's like a misdiagnosis. What hurts? The core of yourself, your ego, your identity, your sense of self. That's what hurts. And that just means, if it hurts, that means there's just something off, right? Because we don't think about parts of our body unless they're kind of broken, kind of hurt. There's something wrong. Maybe there's something wrong. And the other thing, right, that puffed up, that imagery that it creates, is fragile, right? Anything that is that bloated is in danger of being deflated. So it's just kind of like when we built our egos, when we built our value, when we built our identities, our security apart from Jesus, Paul's saying ultimately it's going to be empty, there's going to be some pain, and it's going to be fragile. That's just reality. So here's where we're at in the letter. He says, I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not judge myself. And so we've got this idea that we've got to reject the trap to seek the approval of people. We've got to resist the trap to create our own value. That makes some sense. But then where do we go from there, right? All that doesn't leave us with any answers. It leaves us with possible things to do, but doesn't leave us with any answers. Where is the hope? And this is where the hope comes in and what he says next. And yet he kind of goes about it, and I want to share with you kind of my thinking when I read this verse. He says this right after that. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. And then he says, my conscience is clear, but that doesn't make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. You know what part I got hung up on a little bit? The conscience being clear. He says, I'm not innocent, it's the Lord who judges me. I'm on board with that. But the conscience being clear, that's a luxury few of us have. Right? A lot of us are holding along a lot of regrets, a lot of what ifs if I had done this instead of this. And how could his conscience be clear? If you know anything about Paul's story, it's a bloody one. He was a leader. I'll just share. If you don't, I'll only share a little bit. He's a leader of tremendous stature. He's a church planner. He's an advanced scholar. He was a legal genius. He wrote most of the New Testament, or at least half of the New Testament. Started how many churches? And few people, whether you believe in God or not, could argue that the Apostle Paul didn't drastically alter the course of world history, right? His achievements were many, his accolades vast. But there's also a part of his past that gets talked about some. But before he knew Jesus, he killed followers of Jesus. The dude was a mass murderer. I looked it up. The guy committed genocide. What he did... to followers of Jesus counts as genocide. So you're going to tell me that your conscience is clear? I don't think you have enough lifetimes to back that up. And think about it. I always try to put myself in the Bible character's story. So when Paul writes this, I'm like, really, what was going on in your head? My conscience is clear. And I think, how could he be so bold and confident? And if anyone would struggle with the feelings of perpetually insecure, and being perpetually insecure, excuse me, the nagging pains of inadequacy with something to prove, the constant sense of judgment, wouldn't it be someone with a past like that? Imagine stepping into a church, trying to plan a church, you give a sermon, you give a message, you're going to preach about Jesus and what he would do, and then someone in the audience is like, yeah, I remember you. Didn't you kill my dad? Yeah, I remember you. Your face looks familiar. I think you're the one that took my wife and dragged her out of the house and I never saw her again. Yeah, but by all means, you preach to me, man. Preach it good, Paul. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you put yourself, how do you ever get over something like that, knowing you were wrong? And he realized that. When he came to faith in Jesus, he basically came to faith in the same Jesus that he had killed all these people for following. The level of hypocrisy there is really high. It's kind of astounding. So what do you mean your conscience is clear? How can you say that? But the thing is, it doesn't look like Paul has selective memory. He doesn't have selective memory. He knows who he is, and he's really confident in it. And that's what drives me crazy, because I want that confidence. Where does that confidence come from? He says this when he was talking to some guy, a pastor, young pastor that he was mentoring named Timothy. In 1 Timothy, his letter to him, he says this in 1:15. This is a trustworthy saying, and everyone should accept it. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, and I am the worst of them all. And the tense there is cool, right? Not I was. I was bad, but now I'm better. I did this, but now I do this. I am the worst. I am the worst. And he says that, and he's bold, and he's confident, and it drives me crazy. Because I want that. Because I'm racked with insecurity over things. How could Paul be so free from insecurity, but when you look at his past, he's so filled with reasons to be insecure? What does he understand about identity that I wish I did? Here it is. And this is the third response. This is where the hope comes in. This is where the gospel comes in. You rest in how God sees you. You rest in how God sees you. So a little bit, let me just tell you how God sees you. Let me encourage you. And I said earlier, I want to encourage the life out of you, but I don't want any of you to die. I just want you to leave encouraged. Rest in how God sees you. This is how God sees you. If you're a follower of Jesus, this is the right that you have. Consider the incredible love that the Father has shown us in allowing us to be called children of God. And that is not just what we are called, but what we are. You are a child of God. The label is not external. It goes all the way to the core. And you don't check a box and work towards the child of God status. You are transformed through Jesus, and that fuels everything you do from here on out. There's power in that. There is a massive change of identity. As sons and daughters of God, what does it mean? What does it mean? Well, when you follow Jesus, you've been set into a family. The Old Testament talks about God taking the lonely and putting them in families. It's the heart cry of most people to have a family. We think about our family, it was either great and we look at it with longing, or we think it was awful and we wish we had something better. But the heart cry of people is to be in community, is to be in family. And when you follow Jesus, that's exactly what he says. Sons and daughters and brothers and sisters, there's approachability with God. There's proximity, there's closeness, there's connection, concern, openness, vulnerability. Go to this next image if you could. Don't kids have the closest access, like a weird access to us? They have access to us that nobody else has. Grace, I have a 7-year-old little girl, and she loves to put stuff in my hair. And then she's like, oh, you got a lot of hair in your face too. And she pops those nasty clips in my beard. It's cute, it's super fun, and I love it. If any of you guys did that, I'd be like, you guys are weird, and please leave me alone, you know? Kids have a weird access to us that nobody else has. My daughter, Micah, I mean, she doesn't do all this, she's 15 months old, she'll like crawl up into my lap and then promptly pass gas on me. Nobody else does that! That's weird, you know what I mean? That shouldn't happen! And if it does, you have some weird friends. Kids have this close access to us. That's the kind of access we have to the ultimate Father. And he is good all the time. Paul describes how this happens, right? How we can rest in how God sees us. How we get this new identity. He shares this in another letter he wrote to another church in Rome. Christ arrives right on time. Jesus Christ arrives right on time to make this happen. He didn't and doesn't wait for us to get ready. He presented himself for the sacrificial death when we were far too weak and rebellious to do anything to get ourselves ready. And even if we hadn't been so weak, we wouldn't have known what to do anyway. We can understand someone dying for a person worth dying for, and we can understand how someone good and noble could inspire us to selfless sacrifice. But God put his love on the line for us by offering his son and sacrificial death while we were of no use whatsoever to him. That's your identity, and this is how it's done. When you surrender your life to following Jesus, your identity is forever disconnected from your activity by the blood of Jesus. Your identity is forever disconnected from your activity by the blood of Jesus. It's not a checklist. It's nothing you can earn. It's nothing you can manufacture. It's nothing you can get for yourself. There's a total disconnection. You can't lose it. You can't earn it. And this is how Paul could stand confident as the worst, because he isn't his achievements and he isn't his past sins. He just is resting in that child of God status. He's resting in the confidence of what that means and what that is. Jesus Christ has made the way. It is the gospel. It is the good news. It's the only thing with power. It's the only thing that changes. It's the only thing that saves. And it conveys that Jesus Christ, who is ultimately and entirely impressive, died so that you don't have to be impressive. Amen. Let's stop pretending. Jesus destroys the need for all our standards of impressiveness. The slate that the world tallies you on has been destroyed and erased. And I've shared a similar list, but let me just share it. Because when the gospel enters in, when you let the gospel transform your life, when you say, yes, Jesus, I give you my life, and that child of God status, and you can rest confident in how God sees you. When that happens and the identity is disconnected from anything you've done and anything you could ever do by the blood of Jesus, and you're brought into that new family, you no longer have to worry about the external stuff. And so that means your identity is no longer your rank, your salary, your net worth, your life savings. It's not the clothes you wear. It's not the cars you drive. It's not where you went to school. It's not the fact that you got a degree. It's not the fact that you never finished or that you never started the degree. It's not your intelligence. It isn't your military service. It isn't your promotion. It isn't your job. It isn't your parents. It isn't your parents' hopes and dreams for you. None of these things define you. You aren't your upbringing. You aren't your church attendance. You aren't your husband, your wife, your kids, your failed marriage. It's not you. That abortion nobody knows about and you hope to God nobody ever does. It's not your debt. You aren't your debt. You aren't your unemployment. You aren't your mistakes as a parent. You aren't that one-night stand that changed your life. You aren't that history of bad relationships and casual hookups that you just wish wasn't you. You aren't the abuse you've done to others. You aren't the abuse that's been done to you. You aren't your sin. You aren't your fear, your insecurity. You're none of these things. Your identity is disconnected from all of that by the blood of Jesus, and you get to be his child, and you get access to him. So that's my encouragement. Respond. Rest in how God sees you. Rest in how God sees you. Let's wrap it up here. Those three decisions, those three responses to executing the giant. Reject the trap to seek the approval of people. Then you'll be pulled to the trap to create your own value. Resist that. Resist the trap to create your own value. And the only thing you have left is to rest in how God sees you and embrace that identity as a child of God. So that when you do these things, you execute the giant of insecurity by finding security and your new identity. Because insecurity is the thief of your identity. It will make you feel insecure, and it will tell you you need to be this, and it will rob you blind. It's so good at that. So just practice this. Lean into these responses. Get rid of that giant. Execute it. Whatever area of your life is kind of strewn with insecurity right now, apply this to that, and then let it invade the rest. Let's get practical for a second. We talked about self-talk and the things we tell ourselves that really no one's thinking about us anyway. Let me give you some things to think through, things to think about. And these are the practical things. Ultimately, Seth Godin, he's a writer. He writes a blog, but he writes this quote. I think it's good. People don't believe what you tell them. They rarely believe what you show them. They often believe what their friends tell them. They always believe what they tell themselves. So, tell yourself these things this week. Consider it. And latch on to whatever one you need to hear this week. The first one, their impressions don't make me impressive or worthless. Zero sum. Their impressions don't make me impressive or worthless. Don't think too highly, don't think too lowly. It doesn't matter. Their impressions don't make you impressive or worthless, and they don't make me impressive or worthless. I am not, the second one, I am not what I think I am, but what you say I am. It's the Lord that judges me. Let your identity be infused with what God says about you. I'm not what I think I am, but what you say I am. This last one is cool. It's a prayer. And I think the things that we pray come out of our mouth and they get in our heart and they change us. We believe them more over time. You want to believe something fervently, keep praying it. So this last one, Jesus, thank you. You forever freed my identity from my activity. So this is just some self-talk, some truth statements to lay on yourself this week. Jot it down, take a picture of whatever you need. Whatever one hits you the most, apply that one. Something I'd also consider, I love a couple weeks ago, Pastor Randy had us look at Matthew 6, when we were talking about anxiety and kind of just talk about what causes peace and looking at that chapter. Let me give you something to read this week, food for thought, something to consider. When you have your time and place with God, consider reading just the chapter, Romans 8, and asking yourself this question, what promises do I receive as a child of God? There's a lot in Romans, like so much. Focus just on chapter 8, and that's a lot anyway, okay? So I just want to encourage you, if you have a time and place with God, use this. And if you don't, consider making part of it this week spent in Romans 8. So so that we can execute the giant of insecurity by finding security in our new identities.